So, okay, I know that you don't know, but what about the rest? What do you know about structuralism? Any idea? You come across ever about this? Well, you should know. No. You know a guy with Philip Levi-Strauss? No, Levi. Was an anthropologist. Very funny. What do you know about him? What else? Do you know which work was counting as a more structuralist than the other? It's interesting. Well, where the guy get the idea? Because structuralism means that you can make the interpretation of society or the interpretation of a particular culture using a particular abstract structure. And you, if you put that structure, then you can see how the culture function and how you can understand the function of the different actors and how things evolve and how things change. Basically, this is, you know, shortly, the idea of structuralism. The guy who really defined that in a very big manner, even if there are present of a structuralist approach before him, was this guy working in Brazil. He had a book. Tristes Tropics. Sad Tropics. That is the book. He was working in Amazonia for quite a while, and looking at these Indians, he came up with this idea that behind all the behavior of the people, behind all the symbols they were having, was some kind of pattern, some kind of greed. That he says a good anthropologist will be able to come up with how this structure was working, or more specifically, which one are the elements who characterize this basic invisible structure. And therefore he says, if someone came up with that, we'll be able to understand why these people behave in one particular way, why they eat in a particular way, why they have a particular way to construct homes, and so on. Basically he was saying that a structure can give you the meaning of all the world of these people and how these people was operating. So that was the, if you want, was the beginning. What happened after is that this idea, this anthropologist idea, get entangled with another idea who we discussed a little bit early, who is the idea of languages. Consider language as a base of society, meaning that you only can understand a society if you understand how the language operates. So this idea of a structure get entangled with this idea of languages. Therefore, what happened is obvious. You know that already. The structure became a linguistic structure. So, if you can come up with this sort of linguistic structure, you are going to understand all the concepts, all the meanings, the words, and the object of a particular society. So, basically, you have these three possibilities regarding to structuralism. The ones who were sticking with Levi-Strauss' position, saying that anthropology is the right science to understand this structure. The one who says linguistic is the right area to discuss this kind of pattern. And the one who say no, the best is to merge the two. Okay? These are the three positions that you are going to, with different names, with different explanations, but basically those were the three positions that within the structuralism you can figure out. I mean, if you follow more or less. Indeed, the most successful one, the most popular one, if you want, was the one who merged the two. Because this idea of that language allow you to understand things that other areas do not was very, very a trendy movement that let's say, start in the 50s and go on up to the middle 80s. And that was called the linguistic turn, when almost every discipline was acknowledging the fact that linguistic was a tool that every discipline need to use. Doesn't matter what kind of discipline you are. Could be, I don't know, mathematics, natural science, whatever. So every discipline, one sooner or later, had his own linguistic turn, if you want, in one way or the other. So at some point during the 70s and in the 80s, the sensation that critics were having is that linguistic is everywhere. Even mathematicians, would, as you know, there is this this guy who is called René Thomne. Have you heard of this guy? The theory of the catastrophes? No? This, he was a mathematician. And he was saying that some structures in mathematics are very similar to how geography operates, and in some cases how language operates as well. So the connection there was evident. So this is an extreme case, if you want. But just to give you an example how entangled all the disciplines were with linguistics. Okay? So that is the general sense, if you want, of structuralism. Then, of course, some structuralists go back, or in some ways picking up from Marx some ideas. So they were more orthodox, in the sense in which, for some of them, the structure that they were looking for to analyze in a particular society, they associated with the idea of infrastructure from Marx. If you remember the explanation I give it to you, Marx was working with this idea that we have an infrastructure in which really are the basement of society, and then we have the other structure who work upon this one. This one is a sort of economical reality, whom is the engine of all the rest of society. See? So for some authors, this idea from Marx of the infrastructure was more or less the same that Lévi-Strauss was discussing as a structure. Why? Because it was a sort of pattern who allow you to understand how things operate, how people behave, why a particular culture produces particular objects, and so on. So that is the general context. So so we are on page 79, chapter 3. In the first paragraph, from the last six lines, he says, what was needed was a literary theory which, while preserving the formalist bent of the new criticism, is dogged attention to literature as an aesthetic object rather than social practice, will make something a good deal more systematic and scientific out of all this. The answer arrived in 1957 in the shape of the Canadian Nobel-Prize mighty totalization of all literary genres, anatomy of criticism. This is important because one of the, let's say, problem that the structuralism was supposed to solve was this issue of how we can explain totalities. I mean, how we can incorporate in a particular analysis all the elements who are important in a particular moment of a particular culture, an example. So one of the virtues of the structuralism, according to the creators, was the fact that this pattern should allow you to find explanation to almost everything. Of course, you will produce all the explanations. You just choose one, which is your particular area of interest. But the same grid, the same pattern, should allow you to explain the others. And then, more important, what they were saying is that the explanation regarding to a particular element is entangled with the explanation regarding to another particular element. Let me give you a practical example. There are two types of analysis of a character in a novel. There are people who analyze a character with independence of the rest, and there are people who analyze that character comparing with the rest. So, the first one is clearly known as a structuralist approach, but the second one, yes. Why? Because the only way you can understand how the characters are developed in a particular novel, if you try to think what is the common pattern of all these characters, then you are doing a sort of a structuralist approach. That's very clear. Again, you can apply that to more abstract subjects. I mean, like an example, the idea, let's say for instance, imagine that you try to get the idea of capitalism from a sort of historical novel in the middle of the 20th century, an example. Then you, what you're going to do, you are going to try to see what is the meaning of a capitalism within the novel. You are going to see if there is any common recurrent idea about capitalism through the different characters, to what the characters do, to what will happen in the novel. And then if you think that that happened, then probably you can produce a sort of a structuralist approach, saying that there is a structure there who justify the existence of capitalism in the novel. Why? Because there is a pattern in front of which all the characters behave more or less similarly. You see? So you can put, go up and down with analysis, as depend what kind of focus you want to place with. Of course, you can do that in a more complicated way, and you can do it in a linguistic analysis, in which sense you are going to analyze the language of the novel, and then, well, will be more difficult, because if you really want to make an analysis of the language, well, then you need to analyze the verbs, the kind of sentence that you have, and you need to see to what extension within the language you have a pattern there. That will be not easy. There are some cases, probably those cases are the one that you were referring before, as a very confusing and complicated, because some books who have been associated with structuralism could seem very, very complicated, because always a linguistic analysis is complicated, but also because the critics who were doing the structuralism were thinking that as a critics they need to exercise conceptually speaking what they do. Basically, if they decided that in one way or the other there is one concept which is important for the analysis of a particular society, in the way in which they produce the analysis as well, they should show the complexity of this. You see, they try to do twice the same things, because normally you approach a subject, you produce an analysis of the subject, okay? You do that in a clean way, let's say. But there is another way to do that, who was bringing into discussion with the structuralism. You made an approach to this particular subject, but within your analysis, you only discuss the content. You as well exercise the language, your critic style, in such a way that you put in evidence the analysis that you want to produce. You see, you do that in two things: discussing with the contents, but using the language in particular way that shows the complexity of the content. And that is when the word, as you probably noticed, start to be in brackets, or people start to talk about neologisms and use different neologisms to explain things, and start to twist the language. In English, much less than in French and in another language, because English, the structuralism came later, and English do not allow you to make that many neologisms as other languages can do. I mean, so then is when the discussion starts about if literary analysis or literary critic is a gender in his own, in the sense in which can be compared as a fiction. For example, we have an author produce a novel. Okay, we consider that a value. So can we put in the same level as a value, as a cultural value, the analysis of that particular novel? Is the work of the critic an artistic value as well? The structuralism people were saying yes, because it's something which should be it is difficult to do, it is not easy to do, there are a lot of information to consider, and the capabilities of the critics to produce a particular plot, let's say analytical plot, is more or less the same as the novelist to produce a particular plot about a particular story. So they were considered as an equal. So at the beginning of the chapter, he picking up the chronological speaking, what happened with the new criticism, as he has been discussing. Remember, the new criticism was this movement during the 50s in the United States, mainly, who were trying to change this old-fashioned approach coming from the 19th century. It was a sort of fresh air in terms of literature. because they were trying to do things in a less or historical orientated manner. They tried to do something more accurate, if you want. And more importantly, the New Criticism was probably the first literary movement within university who established the literary critic as a profession, if you want, in one way or the other, as something who is important in his own. Of course, has been examples before, and the critic has been exercised, the critic of literature and culture has been exercised for quite a lot of people before, even in the 19th century. But the status of a discipline was reached when movement as a New Criticism started in the middle of the 50s of the 20th century. Okay? For example, look what happened with the formalist Russians. I mean, they were producing, they were teachers who were dispersed all over the country, one extreme to the other. And they became really critics 70, 80 years later, when they were already dead, the majority of them, because they were not connected. That didn't happen after the 50s, because people were connecting one to the other, and was something called literary critics or cultural critics. Something. That, as a discipline, existed already at the time. Right, so that is when he's coming from. So he's got a little bit not of fry. Eighty-two. Second paragraph. There is a loose sense in which Notenfried work can be described as a structuralist, and it is significantly contemporary with the growth of classical structuralism in Europe. You see, he tried to present Notenfried as a structuralism. I don't think that could be quite appropriate, but anyway, it's to introduce a discussion. So let's go. Structuralism, as the term suggests, is concerned with structures, more particularly with examining the general laws by which they work. It also, like Fry, tends to reduce individual phenomena to mere instances of such law. But structuralism proper contains a distinctive doctrine which is not to be found in Fry, the belief that the individual units of any system have meaning only by virtue of their relation to one another. You see, this is very clear. I mean, you have all the elements, if you want, in a particular structure, and you can understand them only in relation with the structure. You cannot understand them individually. And the other thing is, as he says, is that these are not necessarily law in one way or the other, but should be a logic. I mean, all the analysis during the 70s connected with structuralism were having as a main goal to establish this logic. We identify a particular structure, so we need to identify one thing before to go ahead, is what is the logic with which this structure operates. An example: if you have transformations, an example in one author from one novel to the other, well, how you are going to understand this transformation of this book, one author to the other? Well, because you need to figure out what is the structure behind this work. When you identify the structure behind the work of an author, then you can produce a kind of logic of how this work has been evolved. You see? And then that structure, well, could be concerned with language, as I say, could be concerned with anthropologist elements, or could be concerned with both of them. Those were the three, as I said before, elements. So, oh, sorry. Oh, merci. So, what happened is, example, let's say for instance, one author. You want to understand why one novel from a particular author was so different from another author, from another novel from the same author. Well, then you try to see if there is any change, an example, at the level of the language. An example, I don't know, a particular author was making the first book long sentences and was using the present as a main verbal time. And then in the second novel, maybe he was using short sentences and was using more verbal richness. So what you need to do is to identify what are the common elements between the two, establish a sort of a structure with that, and then to see why this change has happened. What are the gains and what are the losses of that change? And more important, you never can analyze, isolate one author, because if you go up and up and up and up, at the end you figure out that society is in the structure itself. So you see, what happened is this kind of cascade. That was one of the aspects for which structuralism has been heavily criticized, because it can be a never-end analysis, you see. So you have a structure, they assume there, and you go for another one to understand deeply, and then you, that transfers you into another one. So let's say you have here culture, and then in one way or the other you have society, and then if you want you have a particular author, and then if you want you have a particular book, you see. And because this idea that one element cannot be analyzed independent of the other, you constantly are jumping one structure to the other, and the end is madness. I mean, the more sophisticated example, probably, and the more the better example, the example in which things in one way or the other came up in a better way, is the book from Michel Foucault. Well, this is my opinion, not necessarily is the author's opinion, but it's called Le Mot Delicious, the things and the word and the thing. Why? Because it's an attempt to understand almost all the disciplines and the area of knowledge, let's say from 17th century up to today, and if there is any connection between them, and if there is any possibility to establish a pattern. And he came up with this idea of episteme. The episteme, in terms of Foucault, is this. Is this kind of pattern, is this kind of greed, is this kind of structure, who allow you to understand how the natural science were working, how language was working, and so on. You see, this was the other problem of structuralism. The amount of knowledge that you should have to produce this kind of analysis was huge. Because when you start to talk about different knowledge, you talk about hard science, natural science, humanities, arts. So basically it wasn't a sort of pure philosophical approach, because all the philosophers who have knowledge a little bit of everything, at least in the traditional way, were able to produce such analysis. All the other analyses were done with the proviso that they were a sort of small picture within a big picture, so always were having this limitation. And this was one of the elements who was heavily criticized by the critics of structuralism. I carry on. This does not follow from a simple belief that you should look at things structurally. You can examine a poem as a structure while still treating each of his items as a more or less meaningful in itself. Perhaps the poem contains one image about the sun and another about the moon, and you are interested in how these two images fit together to form a structure. But you became a car-carrying structuralist only when you claim that the meaning of each image is wholly a matter of its relation to the other. You see? The images do not have a substantial meaning, only a relational one. You see, this is important, because this is when in art, if you want, all, let's say, ethical purpose or moral purpose disappeared forever. Why? Because normally when you were discussing art or aesthetics in connection with ethics, you were talking about values, and you were talking about a sort of perennial values, the values who are untouchable. I mean, the classic. What was a classic in terms of literature? Were those works who repeat some kind of four or five more important values who always were there. You see, what these people is saying is that these values do not exist. What exists is a relation between things who are historically determined. So that means that they don't rest forever. They change constantly. How you can analyze the change? Knowing the structure. The structure gives you this sense of how historically this connection changed. So we don't have a particular amount of things who determine the quality of literary work. What you have are connections who in a particular society are considered as aesthetics and more specifically as literature. So that means, according to this theory, that for one group of people in one particular century, something could be considered literature that for others in the future could be considered something else, not necessarily literature. And that's indeed what happened nowadays. If you have a look, you read a book from natural science from the 17th century, you feel that it's literature. If you compare that with what we understand nowadays as a natural science, what? Two different terms. Why? Because now for us, a science book presupposes a series of elements who were completely different from what were in the 17th century. More radically, there are books who during the, let's say, 16th and 17th century were considered by the first reader as a literature, and that now, quite the opposite, became a book about sociology, or considered essays, because are read in a different way, you see. So that is the thing that these people were trying to acknowledge as a problem. Let me try to illustrate this by a simple example. Suppose that we are analyzing a story in which a boy leaves home after quarreling with his father, set out on a walk through the forest in the heat and the day and falls down a deep pit. The father comes out in search of his son, peers down the pit but isn't able to see him because of the darkness. At the moment the sun has risen to a point directly overhead, illuminates the pit's depths with his rays and allow the father to rescue his child. After a Jewish reconciliation, they return home together. This might not be a particularly gripping narrative, but it is the advantage of simplicity. Clearly, it could be interpreted in all sorts of ways. A psychoanalytic critic might detect definitive hints of the Oedipus complex in it, and show how the child fell into the pit as a punishment he unconsciously wishes upon himself for the rift with his father. Perhaps a form of symbolic castration or a symbolic recourse to his mother's womb. A humanist critic might read it as a poignant dramatization of the difficulties implicit in human relationships. Another kind of critic might see it as an extended rather pointless wordplay on son. What as a strategic critic will do will be to schematize the story in a diagrammatic form. The first unit of signification, boy quarrel with father, might be rewritten as a low rebels against high. The boy walk through the forest is a movement along horizontal axis, in contrast to the vertical axis low high, and could be indexed as a middle. The fall into the pit, a place below ground, signifies low again, and the zenith of the sun high. By shining into the pit, the sun has in a sense stopped low, thus everything the narrative first signifying unit where low struck against high. Well, this is a sarcastic description, of course, but the idea is that structuralism were producing graphics and diagrams constantly, all the time. So the idea is that visually you need to explain what happened with this, if you want, structure. That is why quite a lot of people coming from visual arts, if you want, cinema, painting, were connected with this movement, because this necessity to illustrate how this structure operates, according to some people, was not innocent. Was happened because we were living, basically we were evolving to a particular society in which thing gets complicated in such a way that the only way that we can express something, that we can communicate, we can illustrate with some simplicity some issues, are with graphics, with images. You see? So that is the reason why some people say that the extraterrestrialism is the movement who produced the first critics regarding to media and regarding to cinema. And cinema probably is the most famous ones, because they create all this area who was only let's say a place for a specialist during the 20s and the 30s, but after these people produced the first structuralist analysis on cinema, the analysis of cinema within academia became a discipline, something that, as I say, was in the hands of some few directors or few critics, I mean, but now became a sort of independent possibility to analyze all those cultural elements who were not visible before. Because, as you know, and we discussed it before, during the 20th century, at the beginning at least, the elements who were considered as a part of the culture were very, very classic. You have drama, you have poetry, you have some paintings, and you have literature. Almost that was it. So then, when you go into the 20th century, other elements came into the picture. Films started to develop much more, you have photography, then you have the media, then you have the TV, then you have all the idea of communication, the fact that without communication we don't have any manifestation, and so on. So all those elements came up as a part of culture. And the structuralism was the first attempt to give an explanation to all those elements altogether. No one had did that before. Of course, some philosophical approach has been trying to cope with all these problems, but no one in humanity has been doing the attempt to do that explanation before. What is notable, 83, about this kind of analysis is that, like a formalism, it brackets off the actual content of the story and concentrates entirely on the form. Yeah, this is true. This is very clear. You could replace father and son, Pete and son, with entirely different elements, mother and daughter, bird and mole, and still have the same story. As long as the structure of relation between the units is preserved, it does no matter which items you selected. This is when some people go into Marxism. Because if you remember, one of the interpretations that I commented to you at the beginning about Marxism was this idea that doesn't matter what you do within capitalism, you have an infrastructure who determine how you produce, so everything is done. There is nothing, the only thing you can do is the revolution, basically. All the things are determined. So this determinism is present here was something that appealed quite a lot of Marxists, and that's the reason why some people who were in the area of Marxism, they feel comfortable with the structuralism because this reason, because they were saying, they were seeing more or less the same, they were seeing a pattern who once you set it up, then there is no possibility to change. It's a sort of fatalism as well. This is not the case with the psychoanalytical or humanist reading of the tale, which depends on these items having a certain intrinsic significance. To understand which, we have to resort to our knowledge of the world outside the text. Of course, there is a sense in which the sun is high and peaks and low anyway, and to that extent, what is chosen as a content does matter. But if we took a narrative structure in which what was required was a symbolic role of a mediator between two items, the mediator could be anything from grasshopper to waterfall. The relation between the various items of the story might be ones of parallelism, opposition, inversion, equivalence, or so on. And as long as this structure of internal relations remains intact, the individual units are replaceable. This is true. This has been very, very common in literature. An example, what was common in literature, there is something that you can do because it's really easy. I mean, it's just have a particular square. The square was probably the most famous figure. And let's say an example, they identify south, north, exist. And then they say an example, male, female, light, darkness. Okay? So they pick it up, this structure, if you want. So they say there is the north and there is the south. Then you got west and you got east. This has a possible directions. Okay? Then you got male and you got female, and then you got light and darkness. So what they do is very simple. They go to a text and they try to see how they work these things, which one work together. An example, in a novel, let's say, for instance, if you have light connected with the north, why? What is the meaning of that? It's because rich people always live north, up in the city, and the poor people in the south. Well, if that happened, then we are going to have as well darkness south. Or you can do it with a classical male and female, in one way or the other. So if women go in one direction in a particular novel, they go where? They go east, they go south, north, why? You see, they try to work how these things can operate in a world. And I tell you, this is fantastical for someone who don't have much time and not much ideas, because it's agreed that you put to work in the novel, and I promise you, you always find out things in the plot. It's so easy. It's so easy. You, for example, think in classical examples, example 19th century literature, think in Dickens. If you're picking up something like that, well, this is, Dickens is music for this kind of world, because you always have a city, you have orientation always, people are moving one place to the other. An example, there are plenty of examples, but in Dickens' Hard Times, if you pay attention, the only people who move, well, the people who move more within the city are the poor, one, because they are the only ones who have interest to go for the poor part of the city to the rich one. The rich one don't go to go anywhere because they are okay. The only time they go somewhere is when they go off of the picture, so they travel abroad. You see, that kind of things, you can pick it up and easily you can produce an analysis. So that was coming from the extrapolation. That kind of association, who later is going to be picking up in a more sophisticated way by one guy who is called Algirdas Greimas, who is one of the father of the semiotics, one particular part of semiotics. And he produced this kind of a square to make a semiotic analysis.